2 of our conversation with Joelle Nielsen about euthanasia. We are going to talk a little about older horses, when they decide to euthanize, maybe before they get too old and the winter is upon us. We talk a little about the process of euthanasia and how we euthanize a horse. So if you are, again, sensitive to this information, this might not be the best topic for you. We'll talk a little about the cremation, the standard mostly in small animal, but equine cremation is an option. And we do work with outside vendors that do provide cremation. And then we will finish up the topic with grief and dealing with grief and how different people deal with grief. So, you know, sensitive subjects, and I thank you for listening to us. I hope that this can provide some information or some thought process of something that you might be personally dealing with, looking at one of your older horses out in the field, trying to decide when the time is right. Again, only you can decide that, but I'm hoping with this podcast that it'll give you a different perspective. All right, and now we return to part 2 of our interview with Joelle Nielsen. Thank you.
Actually, I'm curious for you. So, with those cases, have you had patients that have died naturally?
Not really, no.
Right. Yeah, people usually get to it at some point. It's just a matter of when.
Yeah, I think the only one I can think of that's died naturally was probably struck by lightning.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
I mean,
so
I guess that's died naturally.
Died of old age.
Yeah. They usually will colic, or they will usually, the old horses will usually go down in the ground in the wintertime and can't get up, and the cold just sucks the heat out of them. And then they're just kind of down and
so sad.
Yeah. And most of the time it's we try to get them up.
Yeah.
Sometimes we're successful and sometimes we're not. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's an interesting, we do have that quality of life talk with clients in the fall.
Yeah.
Cause we're we know, cause the ground's frozen too, right? It's harder to bury a horse.
Right.
So there's a lot more logistics.
Right.
So we do have that conversation and sometimes the clients, or maybe it is something at the fall.
Yeah.
Fall vaccine. Hey, let's just consider, we think we have one more winter left in us. Because, the clients know the horse way better than I do.
Right.
But
right.
He stopped eating a lot, and I thought he'd been losing weight.
Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe we do it, think about euthanasia before the winter.
Right. Again, it's that whole setting expectations.
Yeah.
They're probably thinking about it, but don't assume that they are. Let's think about this. What if... I do a lot of what ifs with people. So again, let's think about the pros and cons, or what would make you feel more guilty if you euthanized your pet, or if you didn't and then they died when you weren't home, or whatever it is, you weren't with them, or whatever it is that they want. And so kind of looking at things like that. But I mean, I think definitely in that situation, let's really think about this. What's going to be harder? Is it going to be harder to euthanize now for you emotionally, to euthanize now? Or to find him, like you said, stuck to the ground. Because he's frozen in the ground.
Yeah, no one wants that.
No one does.
Yeah.
And, we don't want people, having their animals suffocate to death or any other type of situation that would be horrible for the animal and for the human to see that happening. I can't even imagine, seeing a horse like that.
Yeah, no, it's not great.
And then what do you do?
Yeah.
If your horse freezes out there.
Yeah.
Do you have to go dig it up?
Dig it up,
And how do you do that when it's frozen?
Excavators, heavy equipment.
Oh, my God.
It's not pretty. Yeah, I mean, you can dig a hole in frozen ground, but it's not ideal.
Right, right.
And the other thing in horses is where we... euthanize them, right? So the other conversation we have is, if your horse dies of natural causes, and maybe, I don't know, anything is natural in a horse, but
they might
colic and die, whatever.
Yeah.
But if they die in the stall, right? How do you get them out of the stall? It's a conversation you have to have, because they aren't walking out of their stall anymore.
Right. Right.
What kind of equipment can you get in there? How much of the barn do you have to pull apart to get the animal out?
Yep. Yeah.
So it's a whole other... So maybe the equine clients are a little more cognizant of that. I don't know how many...
I think more practical.
More practical.
Right? Thinking more of those. Or maybe not necessarily thinking, being okay with thinking about those things because those are real life things that are gonna affect
them.
Where your small animal clients don't really have that. I mean, I think like sometimes like with like our neuro patients where they're gonna like, do you want your dog to be in a wheelchair? Are you gonna be able to carry them around or whatever? So sometimes there's like logistics. But yeah, I mean, obviously with a large animal, those real life things that they, and I think like, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that with horses especially, but and farm animals, like it is a significant amount of money. And so like, it seems to be more maybe accepted that we have to euthanize because of money.
I think so. Like, yeah.
Then the small animal people that are like, you want me to kill my cat because I don't have money? Like, and when I say accepted, I mean it's just more of a...
Like,
probably more people euthanize because of money issues.
That's an interesting study. I don't know. I don't know. I think that people also... No, I think the horses, it is interesting, though, but, like, if you think about prices, though, like, a GDV surgery costs as much as a colic surgery.
Yeah, yeah, true.
But I think that I don't know, maybe I think the equine clients are more rational.
Well, that's what, like, or it's, like, it's just a cultural thing.
It's a
like,
cultural
that is
thing,
like,
yeah.
It's not as stigmatized.
Yeah.
That's probably, euthanizing because of finances is probably more, quote, normal or typical in the equine community.
Yeah.
Then.
Yeah, I think we have very frank conversations with them,
yeah,
too. And I also think for the horses, like, it's somewhat outcome driven.
Uh-huh.
So they're like, okay, so this horse had most horses have had a job.
Yes.
Can it do this job again?
Right.
It can't. Okay, well, so do I want to spend $10,000 to save my horse's life, which I love, and it's a pet. And we definitely see that, like, the little girl's pony gets colic surgery just because it's a little girl's pony.
Right, right.
But, like, you know, I think there's a little more conversation about that, like, how far you would go, even though I think the cost, which is strange, but the costs are the same for a DDV or a horse colic surgery.
Right.
It shouldn't be, but it is. one of them's probably too expensive, probably the GDV, but I think that conversation is much easier to have. But I also think horses, people realize how much their horse cost. Because they pay a lot of money to buy the horse.
Yes.
And then if they pay to feed it, and feeding horses is expensive, they pay for the farrier, they pay for us to see it every 6 months. So, like, they understand costs of the animal. Whereas I think in small animal, you maybe go to the vet once a year.
Right, right.
Hopefully. I don't know.
Maybe
I would assume
not.
They do. Maybe not.
Yeah.
And then you come in with the open mouth breathing cat, and you're like, save my cat. But they've never paid for that cat for its entire life.
Right.
And they bought it, like, Old Roy or something. So,
right.
Like, they don't have much invested in the cat.
Right.
And sure, they still love it, but they've never known what the true costs are of that animal.
Exactly.
I don't know. It would be
interesting.
We could do a study on that to see people's perceptions.
Yeah, what it is about. Because it just, I mean, I feel like it's anecdotal, but I do, I mean, I feel like it is less... I don't know if less stigmatized is the best thing. Like, I don't know why, you know, why it is. Like, if it's because of what you said.
Yeah,
you know, like that.
I don't know,
Because they know how much money, because the horse is about money.
Yeah.
Like, you can't have a horse without money. Like, putting some financial input. You can get a stray cat that comes in your house and you do nothing with
it. Do nothing. Feed it, and then you want to save its life. So.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's an interesting perspective I hadn't thought of, but...
And I mean, I guess it would be interesting, too, between the, like, I'm sure there's a huge difference between horses that are pets versus horses that are,
I think it depends on the client, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, because some of the pet horses, like, they'll spend a lot of money on them because they're pets. They're, like, truly the companion
animal.
Right,
right, right.
There's, like, the show horses or, like, horses that they're trying to resell or something like that. That's a financial. That's almost dairy cattle medicine.
Yeah, yeah.
So the horse is weird because it kind of goes across two spectrums of, like, pure economics and then pure pet.
Right.
So for some veterinarians, I think they struggle with the difference between the two. or the performance horse has become the pet now, or
right.
It's, you know, it's your only horse and stuff like that. Yeah. So I mean, I think that what the dog sleeps in your bed, the horse does not.
Exactly. So I was going to say that. Yes.
It's a little different, maybe. Yeah. A little different. Maybe they feel a little more attached to the dog. I don't know.
I feel like they're definitely the horse owners that are very attached to their horses too. I mean, they might not be like. I mean, you've probably seen owners that have, like, when their pet, their horse is not doing well, that they'll sleep in the stall with them and stuff like that. I mean, I know that those are also the outliers, but I think there are people that do have those relationships. But again, I think like you said, it would be interesting to study.
It would be, because I don't know. We do have the clients, so if the horse, like, colics overnight, they will camp out with the horse all night. Like, that's pretty common.
Yeah.
But... because they want to call us back if the horse is doing bad. But I think they're kind of being like, I don't want my horse to be painful, so I want Doc to come back and, like, not let my horse be painful.
Right, exactly.
Rather than,
I'm not going to go inside and sleep and wake up and see what's going on in the morning.
And I wonder...
rather than it's an emotional attachment.
Yeah. And I wonder, too, like, people with a horse, because they're... large animals, if they're, like, throwing themselves on the ground and actively colicking, it's pretty violent.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not like, oh, my dog is vomiting.
Yes.
And he vomits all the time, but today it's a little red and he's bleeding internally, but it doesn't...
We can't see it.
Can't see it, but the horse is...
I think you're absolutely true.
The horse is, like, really hurting himself.
It's obvious suffering. Yeah. And I feel like I see that with a lot, and until I came here, and even still, like... I always say, if I know that an animal is, like, in respiratory distress, then it is, because I'm a layperson, you know, and I know from working here. But when you look at it from a client's point of view, like, I'll look at a dog and be like, I would never in the world think that dog was suffering.
Right.
So, like, it is a lot of explaining to people what suffering looks like or what is actually happening. When it's the small animals, and like you said, with the horses, you know, like, you can see. If a dog came in the front door and was screaming, might be even in less pain than that, you know, the one that's got a splenic mass or, you know, whatever else. Mm-hmm. I think the auditory stuff really is hard for people. And so, like, you might be more likely to euthanize your dog if it's screaming now.
Yeah.
Or, again, like you said, if a dog was flailing around in that same manner, then that would probably be a more of a no-brainer decision for people, I guess is the best way to say.
But, yeah, so if they say they don't think they can handle it, and I tell them, like, the horse could flip over. I doubt it will, but it could. Right. Like, you might want to stand away. I will call you, like, come back.
Yeah.
We won't euthanize the horse until you're there. I mean, they're anesthetized.
Yeah.
But, like. And you get 20 minutes, so.
There was one, you know, I haven't been involved with many, I remember one, and it was in the barn, and, like, they had the owner step out and said, we're going to go ahead and, you know, did all of the stuff. But even when she heard the horse thud, she was like, what was that? And I'm like, remember, you know, but I was like, how do you even say, like, he's going to fall to the ground?
Right,
I mean, like, it's like, I don't know what her, I'm wondering if she... had ever been involved when they were induced, you know, like,
has gotten better. I remember as a vet student, they used to just euthanize them with just straight euthasol, no sedation.
Right, right.
And that is traumatic.
Yeah.
Because the horse literally dies on its feet and flops to the ground.
Over,
And I don't like doing that.
Yeah,
like, that's...
This you can kind of lead
Yeah, we kind of guide
down
them down as best we can, but, like, it doesn't take that much longer to give them some anesthetic.
Right. Right.
And I feel like in small animals, they've gone that way, too.
Oh,
right?
Yeah,
everything's
yeah.
sedated and yeah. then has a catheter, so you have a vein.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the general practices are doing that as well.
Maybe not.
You would know more than me.
Well, I think, equine it is. Like, we sedate them ahead of time.
Yeah.
And then we actually anesthetize them.
Uh-huh.
So we do tell the clients, like, the horse... is gonna fall down.
Right.
Like, we have to put it on the ground somehow. And we do it in the most controlled manner we know. We use our normal induction drugs we would for anesthesia.
Yeah.
So we can kind of predict, but you never know.
Right.
So now the horse is down on the ground. And then we have the client maybe come back.
Yeah.
Like, we have a catheter in, so then we can administer. So if we're gonna use barbiturates, we'll just administer them and then the horse will, you know, know, rapidly the brain stops.
Right.
During the pandemic, and we didn't, we ran out of euthasol, right? We didn't have any. So, or they wouldn't, yeah, because it was,
that.
Yeah, it was bad. So then we, then there was published studies of using the spinal cord, of using a needle in the spinal cord. So it's like a 3.5-inch needle.
Yeah.
So it's not the most, like, in, you're at the horse's head, like,
right.
putting a needle in the horse's spinal column is not probably the prettiest thing to witness.
Right.
We might have the client at that point turn or, like, say, hey, this is what we're going to do. But they, those horses, they die almost, their brain stops instantaneously. The only difference is their heart beats for like 10 minutes.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Yeah.
So as a veterinarian though, I'm never going to leave the horse with a beating heart, even though I know the horse is brain dead. Like I'm still going to wait to like pronounce it
dead.
And
I think that goes back to what we talked about with setting expectations with clients.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what you said to me, and this is probably what you already do, but saying exactly what you said to me, like, I'm going to stick around. This is, you know, letting them know. And again, like, you know, and that they're probably not necessarily going to be feeling or seeing a heartbeat or whatever, but like dogs, cats, like we'll talk about agonal breaths and it might see something like that. Don't be scared.
Right. Yeah. Same with the horse. Yeah. They'll take big breaths. They're kind of catchy.
I've seen them doing
paddle
the,
and
like,
stuff.
Yeah. But I think letting, if the client knows, I do remember one time. Well, I'm sure it's much different out on the farm, you know, because you don't have, like, when you say, do you have them, like, just turn around, or do you have them go away?
Sometimes they go in the barn.
They're doing
it kind of depends. Like, some clients want to watch the whole thing.
Yeah.
And, like, again, back to our clients being, the equine clients being different, like, you know, they watch the surgeries.
Exactly.
Like, they're in there, and they
want
to be scrubbed in, whereas I think the small animal people aren't really excited about getting in the surgery suite.
Right. Some probably would love to.
Yeah. But, like, we had to, I remember when the small animal hospital was, like, over on our side, like, they had to put the curtains up because the small animal people were freaking out.
Oh, yeah.
That there was,
like,
a surgery going on at the windows.
Yes.
And then our clients were mad.
Because they couldn't look
watch.
In there. I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember that.
But it's just a different subset, I guess, of clients. Like, they want to be there.
I think you're right. So
what about, in like, dogs and cats? How many of them, like, get cremated? Like, do you...
I would say the... So we now have two options. It's either they either get a private cremation or communal cremation.
Mm-hmm.
I would... Now... My numbers are probably skewed because I'm working with the people that are more inclined to cremate. But if I had to guess, like, I would say probably 70-85.
Really?
Like,
private cremation?
Private, yeah.
There's only two options. Like, you can't, there's no more, like...
There used to be a midline, but there's not anymore.
That was like when they had them in multiple things.
Yeah, like a partition cremation.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think Schrodinger actually calls them cremains or something like
that. Oh, really?
Like, you know.
Sounds a little better.
I mean, it's more what it is, I guess.
Yeah.
The remains of the cremation.
The ashes have gone up the chimney. Yeah, so I guess it's important for people, if they're going to choose a crematorium.
Right.
To know if it's private or communal.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And that the partitioning we don't do anymore because we thought it was a little too...
Yeah, but we don't... Well, we also... No. That's another... We did that. We stopped it for other reasons.
Yeah.
The reason I wanted to start the partition was because it was a nice in-between. Because I saw too many families that couldn't afford, you know, the expensive price.
Mm-hmm.
So we're forced to, like... communally cremate, and I'm like, we have to have some in between thing, but now, like, it's just easier to have just one choice or the other. It got very complicated. But my understanding, though, is that the industry standard is this partitioned or
they put,
segregated.
Yeah, they put
or whatever.
Little bricks up and stuff. So
yeah, like more now, more and more places are now saying they only do. Private. And so I think that the more important our pets are becoming to people or more like family.
So what is the normal process of grieving for a person after they euthanize their pet?
It's, everyone is different, you know. I mean, I think a lot of it depends on if it was expected or not.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, certainly if it was an unexpected loss, that can be a little harder, you know, the shock and everything with that. You know, the grief process, again, it's so hard because it is different for everyone. And, you know, some people, like they know it's coming, or their grief process is very short. You know, it might just be a day, mm-hmm. you know, like, and they like will be sad or angry or depressed or like all kinds of things. But then they're like, I kind of knew this was coming and I'm able to kind of move on, where others, that just might be more extended. So it's, you know, it's really, it's so different for everyone.
Would you say the same for like humans? Like if they, like a family member dies, like they're the same grief? Or
I would say, yeah, I would say the types of feelings that they have can be very much the same, especially if they have that really close bond with mm-hmm. them. So yeah, so just feeling sad. And that's something I talk to owners a lot about, is like allowing yourself to have those feelings, because sometimes people don't want to, and just being like, it's okay. You know, with animals, like you'll know what the people that you can talk to, and you'll also know the people that you don't want to talk to, because they're not going to understand what you're going through.
Yeah.
Or you will learn that. And so being able to talk to others that have been through it, or that will kind of understand their grief. So there, you know, there are differences, because it's with animals. And again, I think in the time I've been here, even mm-hmm. like the change in how people perceive pet loss, I feel has been dramatic. Like it's more acceptable to grieve
openly.
Yeah. I mean, there's cards when you go to the Target, there's a whole section of pet loss cards and stuff like that like didn't exist before. The feelings that people experience can be almost identical to mm-hmm. what they would feel if they lost a human.
And how long do you think they should wait till they get another pet? You think they should be, like, is there a set guidelines that you talk about?
What I recommend is not making any rash decisions, right? So sometimes people are like, oh my God, I have to, you know, get another pet. There are people, I mean, I would suggest that people give themselves some time, but there are people that are, like, they just really love having another, like, an animal in the house with them. And so if they said, you know what, I'm going to go out tomorrow and I'm going to get a puppy or whatever, I'm fine with that. I just want to say, like, just, you know, you're not replacing the one that died.
Yeah.
I hear that you really enjoy having animals with you. But again, I think like giving yourself some time, but unfortunately there are no like kind of set answers.
Yeah, I guess there would be. Like we got two of our dogs are 14 now.
Uh-huh.
So we got another like 1 year old dog.
Oh yeah.
So we made the decision pre like them getting too old.
Yeah.
At some point they're not going to be here anymore. So.
Transition
dog. We made an informed decision instead of like rushing out to like get something, which I feel like is always bad. Like you're just like, oh my God, it's so cute, and then it has
exactly
a million anxiety disorders and like I don't know what else.
I had one of those before I worked here. Before I knew better.
Went out and rescued something that was a disaster.
Oh, it was an Aussie. So yeah. If that tells you anything.
So yes,
Thank you for listening to our podcast. We will return to regular scheduled programming next week. I hope to have Dr. Timko back in the co-captain chair next week, and we'll discuss some common horse emergencies. If you have any feedback about this topic, please feel free to share it. If you have any other questions or things you would like answered, please let us know, and we're happy to answer them. Again, this podcast is being developed with the client or veterinarian in mind. We want to provide evidence-based medicine to clients and veterinarians to make the best decisions possible for their animal. Thank you for listening, and have a great week.